stop? Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
All right, here we are. It's Saturday night. This is the Hour of Truth, brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Radio. Missouri Grassroots Coalition, I'm Dave with you every Friday and Saturday night. We're 347-677-1835. 347-677-1835 if you want to get in. Lloyd Sloan's coming along tonight. We're going to talk about the petition process for amending the Constitution. A little different than the convention process. No reason we can't do both. In fact, the petition process will sooner or later lead to the convention process if it comes to that. It's a way to actually openly try to pressure the United States legislature into doing their job. I'm going to just take this call right here and see if it's Lloyd. Hello, who's this?
It's I. It's Lloyd.
It's Lloyd Sloan,
yeah,
the
SRA
guy himself.
Yeah.
So how you doing, Lloyd? Missed you last night, but we had a good night anyway. So,
I'm doing fine. I mean, I can't remember last time we talked, but I think there's big news since then because a bill was filed for state repeal amendment in Missouri. SCR 38. Yeah.
And
I guess you were aware of that, but we haven't talked since it was filed.
Right.
And that's a step forward. A hearing was scheduled but was canceled back in March. For the 25th.
Right.
I assume that will be rescheduled. We'll
I did talk to Senator Lamping's office this week, and they said that they were intending to reschedule that. I shot out an email and a phone call to Senator Lamping's office to see if he wouldn't appear with us here at some time to discuss that. I have not heard back on that yet, but I'm looking forward to that. Any of you listeners out there who are in the senator's camp, give him a little jingle and encourage him to come on here and talk to the rest of us Missourians about his amendment and what we think we should expect from that. Some other exciting news we got into last night, and then we are going to get back to SRA and I really want to talk tonight with you, Lloyd, about this petition approach to amendment. You and I have talked about it together several times in the past, but I want to share a lot of this with the listeners. I think it has a lot of promise, but the other thing we talked about last night that's exciting and needs a little listener action is Mike Moon's impeachment article, H.R. 476, which is getting a hearing on the 22nd in the House Judiciary Committee. So we need to now... there are three articles of impeachment sitting there. I believe all three are actually going to be heard. That's 5 p.m. in Room 3 at the Capitol on the 22nd. I have a couple of concerns. I believe they've pushed this way late in the session. It's got to be heard in the committee, then it's got to be voted out of the committee, and then it's got to be debated and voted on the floor. Now, it's not as late as, say, some of the other things that we're seeing come up too late, really, to do anything to, because this isn't like 38 or something. I don't mean 38. I mean 36, whatever the SAPA amendment is that they were all worried about. This isn't going to be debated in the House and passed in the House and then go over to the Senate, be debated in the Senate and passed or rejected in the Senate, come back for compromise, go to the governor for signature. This is an article of impeachment. The House owns the impeachment process. And so once they vote on this article of impeachment, that's the end. The governor is impeached. Now, an impeachment is just an indictment, understand. Impeachment doesn't mean the House of Representatives gets to throw the governor out of the state mansion and onto the street. That needs to be done, but that comes after a trial. And the Senate then is constitutionally required, after the article of impeachment is passed, to have a trial, at which point the governor's guilt or innocence in this particular charge will be determined. And if he's guilty, then he can be thrown out in the street where he belongs. So that's a little bit exciting, too. And then before we get into this, because we're going to spend the rest of the night on what you and I want to talk about, I want to flash back on just very briefly, folks. I mean, I ranted on and on for an hour and a half last night about this subject, and I don't want to belabor any points or get too redundant here. But we talked about sovereignty. We talked about the sovereignty of the individual. And then we talked about how individuals exercise their sovereignty through the state. In other words, everyone doesn't get to make their own laws. Individual sovereignty probably reached its high point as far as government by individual sovereignty goes in the Wild West, you know, where the guy with the biggest gun was the law of the land. Or the group with the biggest gang. That is individual sovereignty in its raw form. I make my rules, you make your rules. When it comes to you and me dealing together, whichever one has the biggest guns decides what the rule is. So people in our government, or in our government the way it was intended, they exercise their individual sovereignty by banding together as a state, and writing a constitution that drives the rights and wrongs of civil society. We talked about how the state constitution, that's our constitution. That's yours and mine and Lloyd's and your next-door neighbor's and your next-door neighbor's constitution. We own that. And that is the idea of state sovereignty, is you own your state. The United States Constitution, the federal constitution, is not a contract between individuals and the cooperative of states. It is a contract between the states, between the sovereign states, and the cooperative that they formed. The reason I review this quickly, and we went on and on about this last night, and I think if you didn't catch it, you need to flashback and listen to last night's show, because it's really intricate the way this fabric weaves together. But you'll see this thing has come to a head now. When the reason it's so important is because when the federal government decides that your backyard chickens are eating bugs that belong to the federal government, or that you are collecting in buckets rainwater that belongs to the cooperative of the people, who defends you against the invasion of federal forces that come trouncing down on your land? The answer should be your state. The answer should be the state of Missouri, along with the 49 other states, in a cooperative, are the federal government. The 50 states in co-op are the federal government, and your state should be understood to be the champion of your rights to that federal government. That's what you see happening right now is what happens when that ideal is lost. When the states are no longer sovereign, when everyone is submissive to the federal government, and you have no defense when these things come around. And that's when you start hearing crazy people, you know. I mean, before it's time, not that there won't come a time, but people saying, hey, I got my gun, let's go to Washington, you know. When it all breaks down, that whole fabric of the individual sovereignty and the state sovereignty and the really nothingness that should be the federal government when it comes to these matters, that's when we need to go back to the beginning and basically, if we have to, start over again. It shouldn't come to that. I'm of the firm opinion that three or four well-placed amendments to the Constitution could get this thing back under control. There is a move on in many, many, many states right now to call an Article 5 Convention of States where these amendments would be discussed. And there is also another approach to amending the Constitution aside from the one that's always been used, and that is the legislature of the United States proposes amendments out to the states, and those amendments are either ratified or not. We're going to talk about that for a while with the understanding that the way we've always done it in the past is probably not going to happen. Not to the extent of the amendments that we need to make this thing work. This federal government is not going to ever propose the amendments necessary because those amendments mean stripping that federal government, that federal legislature, that federal judiciary, that federal executive of the power that they've amassed unto themselves over the last three-quarters of a century, and spreading it back out to where it belongs. That isn't going to happen. So we're down to amendment by the people. Lloyd Sloan, our guest tonight, has been a champion of the state repeal amendment. I know for a fact for at least 3 years because he's been on this show and we've been trying to let him use this soapbox to educate us on that amendment for at least 2.5 years now. And I am pleased and proud to have him back so that we can talk about not only the state repeal amendment that stands now for the first time ever in a state legislature ready to move, but about the petition process for appealing for amendment. Lloyd, welcome aboard, and thanks for joining us again tonight.
Thanks, Steve. Yep. Oh, yeah. We've been talking about this, I would guess, probably 3 years. Yeah, it's been 2011 at least. So.
Yeah.
And significant progress this year.
Absolutely.
Yep. In Missouri, so that's kind of nice. I just originally conceived the idea, found the roots of it in James Madison and then also in other people who have proposed a repeal amendment back in 2010 even, so it has that kind of a history as well, and, you know, tried different approaches. The petition approach, it was not tried until this year, so that may be a strength as well. And people need to be aware of what we're saying. Most of the fight, frankly, we've been fighting amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
The progressives don't want any. I mean, if you listen to the debates on this, it's all between people who are essentially of like mind that the federal government's too big. You haven't even engaged in the debate yet with the people who say everything's just fine.
Yeah.
Or it ought to get
more federal.
You're going to have a hard time getting to 38 states on an amendment, you know, if you can't even unify your own troops going in. That'd be my thought. I mean, I've started to identify various factions, and maybe even get into the politics of this a little bit. I mean, it's hard for me to name them all, or, you know, the major ones. I've got single state nullifiers. I've got what I call constidolaters. That's what I would consider the Schlafly-eyed and Birchers. And I now have conventionites, possibly, I won't even say Levin types. There's people who basically believe in a convention. They won't even talk about what amendments they want. They just consider the convention itself the answer. Sometimes they're called fivers. I've heard that term. And I guess we are now, or at least I am now, a petition repealer or a repealer petitionite. It would be the faction, little faction. And then, of course, you got the progressives who are the living constitution types, and they're not even part of the debate yet.
Right.
You know, so I would start with just people who think, yeah, the Constitution has some problems. We don't like the way it is. How are you going to fix it? And that's really where the division comes. That is really my first question for the people that don't think amendments are needed at all, okay? They think the Constitution's perfect, et cetera. how are you going to fix this stuff? You okay with the 16th Amendment? Really? You think that income tax amendment is a good thing in the Constitution? Et cetera. All right.
Yeah.
So I have definite problems with people who just bury their heads in the sand and say, there's no problems. We don't really have any solutions. Keep, you know, we'll
or
just
even,
trust that everything comes out in the end, I guess.
Or,
I don't
or even,
know.
Even that, you know, even there's a strong faction of people of the conservative mindset as a general rule who don't believe that everything's okay, but who'll go along and say, well, this is not the road we need to go. All we need to do is educate the voters. What we need to do is teach people the basic principles of liberty and bring up a generation that will vote right. But like you said, Lloyd, I mean, what the hell good does it do you to vote right if the Constitution is fatally flawed? I mean, yeah, you can vote right all you want to, but the 16th Amendment is still there.
Yeah, it's always a good idea to vote right. It's certainly better than voting wrong. So, you know, I don't know how you argue with that. It hasn't worked to this point. Frankly, the people who are telling me to vote right have been voting wrong to this point. So I don't know what good their advice really is. I do think the nullifiers have a case, so they need to be distinguished. They need to be separated from the constidolaters. The constidolaters, by that term, I mean that they worship the Constitution as if it came from God Almighty. It is a perfect document, and how dare you criticize my Constitution type stuff. And this is just unrealistic, unproductive, and no wonder they're trapped. We all know the adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So they are trapped, essentially, into a situation where they can't even criticize their enemy. Their enemy has them pinned down and in a trap. And the only way out is to criticize the mess that we've made of the Constitution, and also that the Constitution itself needs help. It needs amendments to strengthen it. They can't do either one.
Right.
This is particularly, especially true. Most of these people are Republicans. I won't say they all are, but most of them are. And if it's a Republican breaking the Constitution, they really can't do it. You know?
Yeah.
And especially if that Republican calls themselves a conservative.
Right.
Whatever the heck that term may mean. Then they get really... And, you know, I don't want to beat up on them too much, but I have decided, just between us, those people are not going to ever be part of any solution to problems. They are very good at attacking other – they can attack, or rather, any attempt to change something, they're good at attacking. So they counterattack and they play defense. But, you know, to actually give them a problem and say, what's the answer to this? That's just not going to happen, you know. They're kind of like the person that's very good. If you give them a math problem, they can definitely sniff out a wrong answer, I guess. This analogy just doesn't work. But, you know, they won't go buy any answer. So, anyway, I don't want to belabor that because I don't know if it's worth too much. Let me just educate listeners. How do you deal with that kind of person? The correct way to do it is when you're proposing anything, I don't care what it is, and they're just stuck in the mud. You must say, what's your solution? What's your answer to this problem? And that should disarm them because they don't have one. Okay?
Right.
And you know, it's not a choice between doing nothing anymore and trying something. People are frustrated enough that they are going. One thing's become clear to me. We're far enough along now, I think a lot of people are prepared to try almost anything. And that explains a lot of the problem, a lot of the other messes that we're in, too. You know, they're just desperate, no grasp but a sword, and we're not always thinking rationally. Which brings us to the nullifiers, who I have bristled with them, too. They have a different perspective on the Constitution. They're more specific, and if you say to them, well, it's perfect, they mean every state is sovereign and every state can do as it pleases, essentially. So each state on its own is just going to go out there and fix the Constitution. That's, perhaps not the most favorable life, but I think it's a fair perspective. One of the things that Michael Ferris, in a debate with them in Oklahoma that I watched, I think one of his strongest points there was to say, okay, let's say we grant nullification as even constitutional, which I do not. Okay, I think it is unconstitutional, and it's going to rip the union apart. But let's say we grant it is constitutional. How will you use nullification in Missouri to solve the debt problem in Washington, D.C.? How will you solve the debt problem with nullification? And how will you solve the NSA spying with nullification? And suppose the president makes it unconstitutional war. How do you solve that with nullification? So you don't, right? And again, you get, well, it doesn't work for that. Okay, then maybe we need some other answers too, right? We need to keep going. And I hope that realization is dawning, and so we're getting a little bit further down the road. I'm just running briefly through some arguments I see.
Right.
The next step are the fibers. I think that was the other faction that I'd identified. And I reject that solution as well, because what they want, they put the cart before the horse. They want a convention, and they'll tell you the convention is the answer. Well, the convention, just by holding a convention, I reject that that's an answer too. So what I need from the fibers, more than anything else, is what are these amendments that you think will fix the problem? And when you don't get answers like that, when you don't get specific discussions among adults as to, well, I think these amendments would fix it, then take that for what it's worth, too, because the convention is not some holy grail. It's not some Mount Sinai. And as soon as we go to the convention, you know, Moses is going to get the Ten Commandments, and we're all going to know how to fix the Constitution all of a sudden. This is pathetic thinking, frankly. And it's disgraceful, and in some ways, it fuels the very paranoia that most of the Constidolaters have with the fibers, which is basically, you guys are trying to rewrite my Constitution and pull off a coup d'etat. And you know what? When you don't get answers to specific questions like that, why wouldn't you believe that's what they're trying to do? Okay? It does fuel these doubts, I assure them. You know, I need to get more specific than that. The petition approach is designed as an alternative to jumping to an Article 5 convention immediately. How about we try? Each state just starts voting on and petitioning, if you will, don't say voting, but petitioning Congress for whatever amendment ideas they think are good ones. That would help fix the problem. So if it's a balanced budget, fine. Term limits, fine. Repeal 17, fine. State repeal amendment, which we're doing here in Missouri today, that's also fine. And, you know, if we can get it through two-thirds of the state, so say you get this amendment, and I sure hope it's state repeal amendment or something at least as good or close to as good, if you get two-thirds of the states to support such an amendment and Congress fails to act on that, you got to understand, you've got two-thirds of this country saying, you better at least propose this amendment, and Congress doesn't do it, I then think you've got real good grounds and one heck of a foundation to call a convention. And I'll grant you that convention can do a lot of things. I don't see it as a limited thing. But I do know that convention, if two-thirds of the states have proposed an amendment and Congress fails to act, minimally that amendment's going to come out of any convention. We know that's a fact.
Exactly.
So you've already contained its purpose and organized it, and for all I know, they'll just send delegates and say, we're here to do one thing and one thing only, and that's cram this amendment down these guys' throat, period, okay?
Right.
And they may just, and it is, you can make that case. So that, in a nutshell, is and here's what can happen. I mean, you know, I'm just thinking way out in front now, but suppose you never get two-thirds for any amendment. That's a possibility. Suppose you just get 60% for Amendment A, and you get another different 60% makeup for Amendment B, and maybe even get 40% for Amendment C. You still may want, I'm not saying you're bound, but you could look at that and the states could say, look, let's all still call a convention. We've got these
right.
three amendments here that pretty much three, you know, so it's worthwhile to call a convention just with these three, because we got a lot of agreement that these should be proposed. And who knows what comes out, but probably a compromise comes out between those three amendments, perhaps all packaged together or whatever, and that's not bad either. One of the strengths of a convention to me, which rarely gets pointed out, but I do agree with this, is compromise. And so the left, you know, when I say the left, let's just say Massachusetts instead, so we know what we're talking about. or California, you know, or New York or Massachusetts. They got a different idea how to amend this Constitution. Believe it or not, they want some amendments too. We may not like their amendments, but they hate that Citizens United case. The stuff that I've seen out there was I do a lot of constitutional amendment searches. Most of it's balanced budget amendment and term limits, frankly, and Levin has both of those in his book. But you also find an amendment to reverse the Citizens United case. And that is very typical on the progressive end of the spectrum, wherever that end is. And among Democrats, they seem to think that's the one that's really needed. So, you know, the hard question for people who are serious about this stuff, would I or would you cut a deal and in exchange for a state repeal amendment and maybe what you want, which is the 17th repealed, would you give them their amendment and reverse the Citizens United case? And at that point, we'd have three-fourths of states, likely, and voila, it's done. My answer to that question is, in a heartbeat, I'd give it to them real fast. I mean, I would do it. Others can disagree, but this is what a mature look at the process is about. And I don't know, maybe we're too late for a mature look at the process, but you know, I don't think so. I think the American people, the more I'm seeing it, they are starved for an adult view of this stuff. They are starved for people who will offer them real solutions as if they are adults and not children. And we're going to find out if that's true or not. But I believe it. I absolutely do believe it. And people are yearning for it, and they just don't get it. What they get is tribal warfare. What they, you know, it's Fox versus MSNBC constantly. And it's both sides do it, and we're just supposed to team up and fight. And you know who benefits from that, really, is the guys who have the power already.
That's right.
Keep up. That's who benefits. And in every situation like this, somebody does benefit. There are reasons why this Constitution got so messed up. And it's not what you think. That you just see the surface, because you see donkeys fighting elephants. There are very powerful, influential, cultural elites, dare I say plutocrats, who get a lot of more money from the Federal Reserve than the rest of us do, and it helps their agenda. It helps their agenda. They're doing fine, and they don't really necessarily want any of these amendments, but it's not that they do. That's where we got to get to. So I'm done with my rant. There's my quick analysis. I truly believe the petition approach meets all the objections that I've heard from both the fivers and from the constitutionalists and from the nullifiers, frankly. I don't know about the progressives, but I would not want to be a progressive trying to argue against something like this. Well, not when the amendment's popular. If the amendment's popular, this approach is very powerful. I should point out, we've done something like the petition approach in the past. There's no doubt that the Bill of Rights, the First Ten Amendments, were proposed by Congress because they were under a threat by the states to call a convention. the states had already petitioned for a Bill of Rights at their ratifying conventions. So Madison already had the list in Congress of what these states wanted, and he did a reasonably decent job of picking through all those and coming up with a short list in the Bill of Rights. I think that, and Congress, you know, added their value too. It's not just Madison, but they all looked at those proposals and sent something out that has clearly done this country a lot of good. I don't know anybody who thinks the Bill of Rights anymore was a bad idea. Hamilton thought it was, but he might even, but nobody today thinks that. We also passed the 17th Amendment, which is the one you don't like.
Right.
But that was also passed under a petition approach.
Right.
So I guess we could, because states were pushing for it, is what I mean. And they were pressuring Congress, saying, if you don't do this, we are going to convention you. And the same is also true of the 22nd Amendment, which repealed prohibition. I think, am I right about
yes.
that?
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's the right number. So anyway, there's your short list and stuff. Might be, because the prohibition amendment's the 18th. I need to check the numbers. Anyway, I think it's 22nd, but it might be 21st. I'm checking that right now. So,
I was too.
We're probably in agreement, I think, on most of this stuff. So I don't expect
it's the 21st. 21st, 22nd was 22nd was presidential tenure limits.
You know that might, now I might be confusing myself. I need to go back and check the history. I thought it would be that was the 21st that was done under pressure from states. But maybe it was the 22nd because it did take a while to kick that off.
Yeah.
And the 22nd was 1951. It's a little later. So I know it's one of those two. That's all I can tell people, and I won't swear right now to which one it was. And
what I want to do here real quick then, so that people get a firm understanding of exactly how the petition works, is I'm going to read directly from what is Missouri's petition, Senate Concurrent Resolution 38, and let you folks out there understand exactly how this would come about. And this isn't like the 22nd that Lloyd was talking about, where states formally said to the feds, if you don't do this, here's what we're going to do. But the feds, in the case of that, saw the pressure mounting. They saw the whistles going off on the top of the pressure cooker, and they went ahead and did it. In the petition approach, we flat out tell the federal government that if we get enough states together and they don't act, we will act. So I'm going to go to Senate Concurrent Resolution. It's not long, so don't roll your eyeballs yet. It's not like I'm going to stand here and read War and Peace to you. There's a bunch of whereases that basically start any bill or resolution of this magnitude. You know, since the Founding Fathers didn't mean for you to be doing it like this, and since you're doing it like this anyway, and whereas the United States Constitution is being trampled on by you guys, et cetera, et cetera. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the members of the Missouri Senate, 97th General Assembly, second regular session, the House of Representatives concurring therein, hereby strongly urge the Congress of the United States to propose the following amendment, known as the State Repeal Amendment, or SRA. Any provision of law or regulation of the United States may be repealed by the several states, and such repeal shall be effective when the legislatures of a representative majority of the several states approve resolutions for this purpose that particularly describe the majority of several states is a majority of the states also having together a majority of the representatives of Congress. And be it further resolved that should the Congress fail to act, after two-thirds of the several states petition alike in substance for a state repeal amendment, then a convention to propose amendments under Article 5 of the United States Constitution shall be the proper course, and that delegates to such convention should be selected by the legislatures of the several states and should vote by state according to the practices established in the 1787 Federal Convention in Philadelphia. And be it further resolved that the state of Missouri reserve the right to petition in the same manner for further amendments as the General Assembly may deem warranted, and be it further resolved that copies of this resolution be forwarded to the legislatures of all the several states, inviting them to likewise join in support of this petition, and be it further resolved that the Secretary of the Missouri Senate be instructed to prepare properly inscribed copies of this resolution for the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, the President of the United States Senate, and each member of the Missouri Congressional Delegation. So that, in a nutshell, is the petition approach to a specific amendment. We say, here's a specific amendment we want. We get that approved by the legislature of the state of Missouri. And then we send copies of that resolution to 49 other states and to our delegation in the federal legislature. The hope being that we get 34 states on board with this specific call for amendment. At that point, the Congress will either act or we will convene. Does that sound right, Lloyd?
That sounds right to me. Okay. You know. It's fairly, yeah. I mean, it seems, you know, I like the directness of it, and you know, it's, the lawyers always like to be legally binding. So I can tell you, now they say, well, this doesn't do anything. No, it's a petition. It's not supposed, you know, it doesn't technically do anything. You know, I think you got to think of it this way: if I dumped on Obama's desk a petition, and it was signed by 200 million Americans to repeal Obamacare, I expect he'd get his attention.
Yep.
Real fast, okay?
Yeah.
That's a lot of Americans signing a petition.
Yeah. That's 13.
Especially if the petitions. Yeah.
13 more million than signed up for Obamacare.
Especially if the petition was signed by two-thirds of Congress and said, we believe the proper recourse if you don't do this is impeachment.
Yes. Yeah.
That would get even more attention, I suspect.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's basically what we have here.
That's what you have there. What you have there is political power, not legal power.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that's what I'm saying. And what's fascinating to me is no one's ever tried this approach before, not that I'm aware of, not in this formal sense. As I said, they have pressured Congress in the past to pass things.
Right.
But it was mostly... It was a one-step approach, I'll say. This is more of a two-step approach.
Yeah.
And people in computer science will know what that means, or in math, but and engineers will know, but not. Well, everybody knows what two steps is, so you know. But even in baking, I guess there's two-step approaches, right? Some cakes you can't just bake all at once. It takes two
right.
steps to bake the cake.
Right.
And that's what this is. Two steps to bake the cake, people. All right.
Yeah.
There's the first step is petition, and we really don't know at this point what amendments will be popular or not. I suspect that if you took this approach, say, on the balanced budget amendment, you would have better success, okay? Because the balanced budget amendment is very popular. I don't think it's that great an amendment, but I would like to see a debate on the balanced budget that would possibly result in a better amendment, all right? And that would be a useful thing to me, and we can get into those discussions. The problem is that even when we propose balanced budget amendments, we rarely talk about the merits of that amendment. You don't hear people saying, well, how is this going to work, and how is that going to work, and what about the Federal Reserve, and could they automatically impose a tax increase, and, you know, what about wars, and all the details that come up, which I think are valuable to discuss and get right. Instead, we end up talking about the convention, you know, and should we have a convention or not? Well, you're putting the cart before the horse, people. It's not what we need to be arguing. We need to be arguing what amendments can actually fix this out-of-control federal government that we pretty much all agree is the problem.
That's exactly right. Before we move on with that, I mean, that was a perfect example, Lloyd, and I want to belabor that point for the listeners just a little bit. I mean, we hear a lot of call, and when you do try to pin someone down, as you pointed out earlier, I mean, that's one of the first things they say. Well, what amendment would you like? What is your most important amendment to come out of the Convention of the States? And I dare say 70% of the time it's balanced budget. The other 30% of the time, 29 of the other 30% of the time, it's term limits. But people are concerned about the fiscal irresponsibility. People are concerned about the debt that we're passing on to their great-grandchildren. And so clearly 70% of the time what you hear is balanced budget amendment. And exactly what Lloyd said, folks, I want you to dwell on that before we move on too fast here for just a minute. To the things Lloyd just said, I mean, you and I can sit around over a beer and we can say, yeah, we need to balance the budget. Okay, that's great. That's great. We need to balance the budget. You know, candidates can run from now ad nauseum on I'm gonna go to Washington, I'm gonna balance the budget. I'm gonna propose a balanced budget amendment the day I get to Washington. But how does that work? I mean, there's a lot of detail that needs to go into the discussion of how does a balanced budget work? You know, when suddenly something, you know, a 9/11 occurs, does that just automatically kick in tax increases for everybody in the country? Because we have to balance the budget? I mean, does that just automatically say to everyone, okay, taxes got to go up because we got to keep a balanced budget? Do we not fight a just war because we would have to borrow money to do so? You know, it's these kind of details that have to be talked about and discussed. And as Lloyd's been trying to tell you, you don't just go to a convention and say, okay, we're here to talk about a balanced budget amendment. Let's write this down on a piece of paper. The Congress shall balance the budget. Send it out. Let's get it ratified.
Yeah, I know. This is what scares me, too. That sounds just like, I mean, it's chaos if we think that's going to work, and you know, the answer is not let's throw up our hands. Well, I guess it's impossible. Boy, they'd sure like you to believe that.
Oh, no,
know,
the answer
they got you
is
right
to,
where they
yeah.
want you. You start
the
throwing
answer,
up your hands, saying,
"The
well,
answer is
I guess
to roll up
impossible.
Our sleeves and have this debate." You know, and if this SRA, Lloyd. That's so carefully worded, that takes care of the details, that takes care of defining the terms of what a representative majority is and defining the terms of what can be repealed and defining the terms of where and when a convention gets called if the Congress doesn't act and how the delegates to the convention, all of these things that are taken care of, if this goes out to the 49 other states and let's say it sparks a debate. Let's say somebody wants to make a change here or there or somewhere else. Then, as you've already noted, long before 34 states get the nose turned up at them and we actually have to go to a convention, the details are already ironed out or at least on the ironing board and the iron is hot.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the intent. And that's, you know, and that's the precaution. You know, we try and listen to each other and our each other's concerns and try and meet those concerns, and I think that's what's been done here. And it's a fairly safe approach and yet a productive approach because we are building consensus all the way along. The fivers don't seem to understand that they are dividing our side with this. By our side, I mean, again, the people who see the problem in Washington and want it limited. That's our side, right? And I think all the people that are concerned about the convention, nevertheless, are also concerned. I'm not accusing them of being progressives. I'm not saying that they don't care about the problems. I think they do. And so, you know, I don't want to be divided from them. I want to be unified, you know, and that's what this is. So once again, you got to go to them and say in a mature way, okay, what's wrong with this proposal? What don't you like about this one?
Right.
You know, you owe me that answer, right?
Yeah.
And what's wrong with SRA as an amendment? I told you my concerns with balanced budget amendment. I think a balanced budget amendment is a farce if it doesn't deal with the Federal Reserve. People need to understand that this whole debt wouldn't even be there if we didn't have the ability for the federal government to print the money at will. That they have destroyed the currency, really. I mean, we all see the inflation. But the inflation is not just year to year. This is what was the price of gold, for example, before the Federal Reserve Act? Federal Reserve Act is back in 1913. The price of gold stayed, I would say, roughly stable in the United States. At the time of George Washington, it was $20 an ounce. At the time of Abraham Lincoln, it was $20 an ounce. You know, at the time of Grover Cleveland, it was $20 an ounce. And it was $20 an ounce when Woodrow Wilson came in, okay? And this country minted a $20 gold piece that was an ounce of gold. Now, these are rough, you know, it fluctuates slightly, but that's basically what happened. What's gold today?
Yeah.
I don't know, but you know, and this is the pattern. You don't have to just use gold. Look at the price of gasoline. Look at the price of bread. Look at the price of movie tickets. You know, I don't care what you look at, of corn. You know, and look at it historically over a long period of time, and then you understand that, and I think most people recognize this. If I ask you, if I ask the average American, you know, do you balance your budget in your home? And they'll say, yeah, I sure do. I got to balance my budget. Federal government ought to balance theirs too. My God, you know that, you know. And then so you can say to them, okay, if you balance your budget, how do you get in debt?
Right.
If you balance your budget, how'd you get in debt?
Right.
Well, I had to. I had to buy a house, got a mortgage. Yeah, okay. That's what the government does, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're doing. The problem is their debt is out of control, and their problem is deeper than you think. And believe me, they got an army of accountants who are just going to say everything's balanced, even though you're going massively into debt, same as you think you're balanced. Okay, same thing. You know, this is why this stuff's more complicated than people might think, and it has to be worded properly. You have to. The founders deliberately gave us the ability to go into debt. It was one of the, I think it's the second power that's listed in Article 1, Section 8, it empowers Congress to go into debt. Actually.
And let me just stop for a second. Because this is important for the listeners, too, and we're going to move on too fast, and they're not going to get this. You're absolutely right. The founders provided that we could take on debt, and I say that is extremely important point, because one of the disastrously fatal flaws of the Articles of Confederation was that they were unable to pay the debt.
Yep.
You know, I mean, one of the reasons that the Articles of Confederation were crumbling underneath their feet was that the Confederacy was unable to service its debt. And yet the founding fathers who gathered to fix that gave us a way, in fact, intended for us to be able to assume, when we needed to, some debt. Go ahead.
The first power granted to Congress, so that was correct, was the power to tax. So it says,
right,
Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, blah, blah, blah. It then says the Congress shall have power to borrow money on the credit of the United States. So that's the second power listed,
right,
which is what I thought. So they specifically said it was okay. The one thing the founders didn't like, that we are breaking, frankly, is paper money. They were not fans of that because they've experienced it under the Articles of Confederation. We still have the phrase in English, it's not worth a continental. What that means dates all the way back to the American Revolution, and it was referring to the continental currency. So the continental dollars that were printed paper-wise. It's also true that states printed their own money, too. that Rhode Island, in fact, was absolutely, dedicated to paper money. It was how they were going to pay their debts. And so that is why they oppose the Constitution. The Constitution in Article 1, Section 10 says no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a payment, a tender for payment of debt, something like that. So the founders, I think arguably that would be their bigger concern is just, you've given the federal government the power, not just for infinite debt, but really what drives it is their infinite power to expand the currency under
right.
under no constraint at all. Congress doesn't even vote on this. This thing is so corrupt that the Federal Reserve can expand the money supply, just essentially creating money out of thin air. And it's
right.
My goodness, it's not even voted on in Congress.
And,
it's just totally
and just as an example to you folks who aren't economists like Lloyd is, because he talks about these things like we all ought to know what the hell he's talking about. But
sorry.
But he was talking about gold and gold being worth $20 an ounce during the Revolution and $20 an ounce during the Civil War, with very little variance in between the two times. The fact of the matter is that if you should have walked into a gas station with gold in your hand when your grandpa bought a gallon of gas, you would need about exactly the same amount of gold today at the dollar value of gold to buy the same gallon of gas. So the value of a gallon of gas in flakes of gold hasn't changed. The value of the paper that you push across the counter at the gas station has changed.
I have a great anecdote. I'll share this with you because people may remember who John Bruner was. He ran ran in the primary last time for the Republican nomination for Senate, and Todd Akin won that primary.
Correct.
Bruner came in second, and Steelman came in third, if I recall.
That's correct.
But John Bruner used to do he did a great speech. I watched him just on the problem of inflation. And he had a quarter with him and brought it out, and it's a quarter from 1961 on the quarter.
Uh-huh.
Quarters at that time had silver in them. Okay.
Right.
So, and he would say, I remember growing up in 1961, gas was 25 cents a gallon. And people say, and of course all the young kids, 25 cents, that's nothing, and you're right, it's not much at all. So gas was a quarter. And then he pulls out this quarter and says, gas is still a quarter if I use this quarter here.
That's right.
If I use a 1961 quarter that has silver in it, gas is still a quarter a gallon. And sure enough, silver right now, I don't remember the exchange, but it's about $4 or $5 an ounce or something. So, it was still worth a gallon of gas, basically. There's your problem. That is it in a nutshell. And it illustrates it very quickly. We all sense this because we all see the prices go up. We're so used to it. I mean, I don't know what it costs now for a Big Mac or a cheeseburger, but, it's been a persistent problem. And people, I hope, are waking up to this. I'm not an advocate necessarily for a gold standard. I'm sympathetic to the modern economics just use a gold standard. I know Keynes thought it was just a total barbaric relic. He called it, and that's great. I mean, I grasp his point, and I'm not necessarily arguing with it, but I do know I'd rather have that barbaric relic than this out-of-control system you've got now.
Yeah,
okay?
Exactly.
I mean, that's a poor excuse to just absolutely steal every American blind and give it to Goldman Sachs, all right? The abuse is – so what we really need is a sound money. We need a way to limit the amount of money that the federal government can put out there. We need to hold it politically accountable. That is a very valuable amendment, in my opinion. We can get that back, or we can get an amendment that does that, both limits the debt, focus on the debt, not the deficit, but the debt, and focus on the money supply. Now we're getting somewhere, and I'm more interested at that point, and I think we have more serious limits. But at the end of the day, all those limits are going to be subject to exceptions for war, and war is the biggest one, but other exceptions in economic crisis, et cetera, where we're willing to pull the trigger and do something different. and maybe, you know, not play by the same rules. That's going to happen. That's reality.
Something like TARP,
I mean. Well, TARP I was opposed to. I need to make that very clear. Yeah, I don't want to be misinterpreted. This will get really so technical, and I don't want mean that to happen. But when people are scared to death because of that meltdown that we had back 2007, 2008, and, you know, the housing market collapses, you get this bubble and stuff, and people don't understand it, I don't blame them. I would not have done the TARP bailout, guarantee it, but I certainly do recognize that I didn't want runs on the bank. I mean, panic is getting ready to set in, so that part I will concede. What I would have done probably, in fact, I'm almost sure, is bail out the FDIC, which is a dangerous thing to have around anyway, but you know, that's not the time to argue the point when everything's melting down. So the average American was insured in their checking account up to $100,000. I would have kept that whole. That was a promise made by the government. We are going to keep whole your checking accounts. And so every single American who had less than $100,000 in a checking account would have been safe, even if their bank went under. I would have let the bank go under, and I would have bailed out the FDIC so that the average American was not wiped out by that. And, yes, there would be some very unhappy bankers with me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's the truth, okay? But to me, that's what I call Titanic rules, okay? The law of the sea, if you will. And you save the children and women, and the captain goes down with the ship, and, you know, if you bankers were not – I'm not saying all the bankers were guilty because I do not believe they were, but I'm sure I'm certain that some were, and those are the ones that are going to have to pay a price, no doubt about it. I'm sick over the fact that Goldman Sachs, after this bailout, was paying record bonuses to executives within a year and a half.
Yeah.
People.
Yep.
You're still struggling because this economy, you know, it's amazing this upper class says, thank goodness we've recovered. You know, recovery has kicked in. I'm thinking it did kick in for some. It sure as heck did not kick in for the average American. And it hasn't kicked in. Obamacare is making it worse, frankly.
Absolutely. So, we're behind on a break. We're going to take it right now. Keith Carmichael's sitting in the wings. He'd like to come on and have a say. We'll get to that when we're back.
Come springtime, so let me hear you say, my love, I'm gonna stand my ground. They rise to me, I'll blow them down.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Yeah.
All right. The new Wild West is going on in Nevada now, where the federal government has announced a stand down at the Clive Bundy Ranch. More on this tomorrow. Hey, you know what? I mean, just we talk about this all the time. And I took my dog out this morning to the dog park, and one guy and I were standing around talking about the Clive Bundy thing, regardless of whether you think what your opinion is on it. And there are plenty of people who are conservative, who are liberty-minded, who think maybe Clive Bundy jumped a little bit over the line and brought the wrath of the law down on him. And there are just as many people who are liberty-minded patriots who think that that even if he did, the Black Hawk helicopters and SWAT teams may be a little much. But regardless of what you and I think about it, we were standing there talking, and at least four people had no clue of what we were talking about. And I thought, my God, are these people totally out of it? And so I came home and I wrestled. I don't ever listen to network news, and I don't ever read the local fish wrapper. But I did come home and wrestle the newspaper out of my wife's hands, and I could not believe it. I mean, I've heard the horror stories about the mainstream media, and I don't even participate in it. I don't pay any attention to it. I don't watch it. I don't have anything to do with the with what people call the mainstream media. But my God, page one, where all the important news happens, was almost totally about the football player at MU, Doriel Beckham Greenwood Francis Scott Key, whatever. The entire damn front page of the paper. So I thought, well, maybe page two. No, page two, marijuana. Marijuana in Colorado and the effect it's having on people in the workplace. There was some stuff on page two about a fiery bus crash in California. I worked my way all the way through section A and section B, the first 27 pages of the Saturday morning newspaper. Saturday morning, low ebb in the news cycle, and there was not a damned word in today's newspaper about what's going on in Nevada. Wow. Now that's an eye-opener, folks. That is absolutely an eye-opener as to who owns your media and what's going on out there. Okay, Lloyd and I have been talking for an hour now about the state repeal amendment, about the petition process for amendment to the Constitution. The director of the Missouri Coalition of Convention of the States, he's been with us many, many, many nights. He's educating us on the Convention of the States and how that's going. He's talking to us at least weekly here at Missouri Grassroots Radio about how things are coming, about how it's going, about how the COS coalition is trying to get this thing working. And he's called in tonight to say howdy and to weigh in on what's going on here. Our good friend Keith Carmichael, how you doing, Keith?
Hey, good evening to both of you gentlemen.
How you doing?
Hear your voices
evening,
on
Keith.
The Grassroots Radio.
Oh, yeah. Good to hear you too again.
Yeah. It's been a good evening. You know, it's interesting. I don't know really where to start. I really wanted to key in. The place I wanted to key in the soonest, the earliest this evening is when Lloyd was going over the different factions and talking about folks who don't have a solution, and it just reminded me of during the hearing on HCR 41. That was back on April 1st. One of the people in the hearing, and I won't tell you which one it was, but one of the legislators leaned over after this gentleman just went on and on about how scared he was and how he was just afraid of the convention process and how they're, you know, he finally just said, well, what's your solution? And this gentleman, I really felt sorry for him. He really honestly was just testifying, you know, what he really thought and was from the heart. And he just kind of went silent, and he just put his head down. And it was quiet, and I don't want to exaggerate, but it was a long time. And I was thinking to myself, you know, if the folks who were there supporting HCR 41, if we'd have paid him to do that, we could have paid him to come in there and do that, because that was very, very effective. It just showed the final exclamation mark, be it an underline, that the folks who are against this process don't have another solution. Now, there isn't, that I know, another solution. So, but Lloyd's exactly right. That's the question you have to ask when people take that route is, you know, well, what's your solution?
That would have been a good time probably for me to pay him to say, how about the SRA petition approach?
Well, I got to tell you what happened this week.
I
have two or three minutes.
You know, real quick.
Yeah.
Well, I
was up there
one.
in your backyard, Lloyd, promoting the state repeal amendment yesterday. We had a meeting with a group, and there was about 30, and my wife went along for the first time. She had never been along on one of these trips, but I made a trip over, actually, St. Charles County, and at noon, and visited with the group, and there was just, I just kidding. Somebody asked me today how it went, and I said, well, I don't know that it just couldn't have gone any better. Had several district captains from COS, Convention of States District Captains. We're trying to put together a district captain in every House district, if possible, in Missouri. Our goal is three-fourths of them, and we've got a long ways to go. But there was five of them, I believe, over there from different parts of the area, different area. And but when I came to that part about some of the examples of some amendments, you know, I have a little elevator speech that I use, you know, like the 30-second one, you know, like, for example, people say, well, what will you do, and what can you do? And I don't get into the process of, you know, really it comes down to the delegates at this convention will determine those amendments will go with them. They will be, it's a deliberating. That's one thing that's that Robert Nadelson points out pretty clearly every time he talks, is this process is a deliberating process, and that's something the founders meant for this group. It's just you don't send an amendment to them as a group and say, okay, give us an up or down vote. They actually deliberate themselves. But I explained several of them. My short version is, for example, some of the things that you might propose and I might propose that, you know, if after you've been out there 12 years, 16, come home and get a real job. But I learned this week that I've learned that there are some folks who are not for term limits, and they have some, you know, there are some arguments, that parts of which I can agree with about term limits. And so I'm really in favor of listening to what people have to say, and the most recent idea that I've heard is what's called rotation in office. Sure, go there for two terms, however many years, depending on what you decide. But then you come back. Benjamin Franklin argued for a rotation in which you set out for two terms, and if you want to go back, fine, go back for another term or two. But the point is you're rotating and coming back to live and run a business or whatever under the laws that you create. And right now, the corruption that we have, whether it's the corruption that you go to jail for or just the little stuff and loopholes, I think is a result of people going out there and becoming career politicians.
I don't know if people are aware of the history, but the rotation in office was actually in the Articles of Confederation. It was not a bad, and I believe the rule in the Articles was you could serve no more than 3 years out of any five, and that was the constraint in the Articles. It's set up a little bit different, but that is what they meant by rotation in office in the Articles. But, yeah, I believe, well, we agree on almost everything. But I've never actually, you know my opinion of the Convention of States. What is your opinion, I want to know, of the state repeal amendment petition approach? Are you familiar with
it? I knew we were going to get here. That's why I pulled it out and printed it out earlier this evening and made a PDF of it and marked on it. And because, Lloyd's been wanting to know what I think of it. And, you know, we're going to get there here in a minute, but I'm going to tell him my opinion is going to be worth exactly what he pays for it. You know, honestly, because when I say that, what I mean by that
I'm going to have to collect interest on that opinion because it's taken me a long time to get.
Yeah, I know. He is right. He's been wanting to know, and I've been.
Well, I mean, you understand the frustration, don't you? Think it's a fair question.
Yes, I do. And I don't mean to belabor it. I went back and read it a couple different times, and I thought, what's the purpose? Some of the things that really, just don't push my buttons. The part that doesn't make me too excited. I'll just give you the words that don't excite me. Hereby strongly urge Congress. That's okay, but I support this, by the way. Don't think I don't support it. The point is strongly urging Congress is like, I wrote underneath this. I said,
yeah.
Now, not even Lloyd thinks they will do this.
I do think they would do it if enough people jumped on, but I don't think they'll do it just because Missouri strongly urges them. It means nothing to them. Yeah, it means nothing. It only means something if you get two-thirds of states to do it.
If two-thirds of the states...
You said something this evening about Barack Obama, and I don't remember the number you used, but you said if he put a petition on his desk with, what did you say, 210 million people signature?
That's a good
personally
number.
Don't think it would faze him. I think he's such an ideologue.
I think he would be unwise to ignore it.
I don't think at this point, at his second term, I'm just thinking, this is my opinion, but he's such an ideologue that you couldn't put enough signatures on there.
I don't know the man. If so, he would be the most principled thing I think he ever did in his life. Because, I can't imagine any American politician being handed, do you think the governor of our state, it's just true of any organization. I don't want to name names, but let's say even in your own organization, convention of states, if two-thirds of the people who have given money to this cause and who are working for it all signed a petition saying, you know what, we want to do it this way. We like this SRA petition approach. Let's do it that way. Do you really think the leadership of that organization would ignore such a petition? I don't.
I don't think they're ideologues.
They would be
fools
to do so.
No. And I think there's more agreement in what some of the amendments are. Lots of agreement what the amendments should be.
Correct. I'm sure there's disagreement on the amendments. What I'm going to tell you is that's the strength of the petition approach. You don't know what amendments are popular. Neither do I. We need to find that out. This is a way to do it. Okay? This is the way you do it.
Let's back up one second because we're missing. There's something happening out there that you and I aren't a part of, and really the convention of the state's leadership, and we'll just say most people know who they are. They're not really a part of it either. There was a meeting in December of 100 legislators from about 33 states in December, and there will be another one in June, and there's going to be a third one. So there's two more scheduled, and I know they don't have a lot of weight of law. But what my point is in terms of organization and some of the brainstorming in terms of what kind of amendments will be popular, those are state legislators in those meetings. They're having those meetings. They're scheduled. And frankly, I think for most states, if you were to take a poll right now, if you could look into the future and say, who will these delegates be?
Who went to that? Right.
I'm sorry, I missed it. Go ahead.
Well, my point is going to be, okay, that's great. I'm all for these meetings. Did they produce any amendment proposals? Did they mention anything? Because the guy I know that went, when I asked him, what amendments were they talking about? He didn't talk about any amendments. So what good are they? What good is that? What do they think the purpose of such a meeting is? That freaks me out. I'm sorry. This makes me very nervous.
I'm still searching to find the right analogy, but here's the best thing I can say.
You want an analogy?
I've got mine. Just listen to it. We're talking about going to we're going to have a little surgery. They're going into an operating room, and we're going to work on a number of problems. I think Lloyd and a number of people agree that the balanced budget amendment is good as it, and I don't. We need to quit talking about a balanced budget amendment that's going to let taxes continue and spending continue. I do think you've got a great point when you mention the Federal Reserve, and when you do, I have to start using that brilliant word again because that's above my pay grade. But when you start talking about the Federal Reserve, I think you're exactly right. The formula, the amendment, whatever they do is going to have to be all-inclusive. And I think there's some, if you look at the Compact for America and there's some other ones, there's some good, there's lots of good ideas in these, but I don't know that any have addressed that. But we both agree the balanced budget amendment by itself is as important as it has to be, I mean, as it is, it has come to be because of the debt and the way it just continues to climb. It's not going to get the balance back that we call federalism. Our Constitution has been hijacked by the ideologues in the Supreme Court that have interpreted it in such a way. I mean, there's two constitutions. There's one that's written and one that's been interpreted. And right now, you know, if you ask them if they're following the Constitution, they would say, oh, sure, we're following the Constitution. Well, they're following perhaps the one as it's interpreted. And so that is what has to be solved, and you can't do that with a balanced budget amendment.
Well, let me go back. Let's focus back on the SRA petition approach. So you don't want to say strongly urges Congress to adopt.
Well, I wasn't done yet. I got a couple other words I don't like either.
Okay. Well, I was going to try and fix that one for you. Okay?
Let me give you all of them. This next section says, should Congress fail to act? Now, wait a minute. When has Congress actually acted? I know what you mean. I know this is a process. It's a two-step process. Then we come to this part. Then
your problem.
Then a convention of proposed amendments shall be. So my question was tonight. And I tried to get in just to ask a question a while ago, just so I can have you clarify it. So what you're saying is, then a convention proposed amendments would be in order. So then we would start. Then to try to get 30. Well, you'd have a petition. You'd have these states at least on this issue. But you'd start again through the process to get 34 states. Is that correct?
It wouldn't take very long because they're already committed. Missouri would, in essence, be committed to doing it. Right?
But you'd have to go back and have a pass
believe,
again.
Well, of course. Of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's official. They have to pass it. They haven't done anything yet that's official.
Lloyd is saying. This is unofficial, and they would have to start over and do it again, whereas if Missouri
and do everything again. What they do is at that point they simply follow through. They do step two in the process. They've done
there's some things that in the time it takes for this to happen. There's a number of things that happen that you know will happen. For example, whoever your sponsor that sponsored it, for example, might term out or might not be reelected, or you know, there's all kinds of the change in the legislature is a little bit.
Time out.
Yep.
The way this resolution, first of all, the call to convention that's going through the Missouri House of Representatives at this time that just had a hearing is a continuing resolution, HCR, right?
41. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what's official about a House continuing resolution?
Well, it's not until it's passed in the House and goes to the Senate, and then when they both pass it, it becomes
now,
a call for a convention.
The way I read, and do you have, Keith, do you have SCR 38 in front of you?
I do.
Okay. The way I read SCR 38, if three-fourths of the states... Or two-thirds of the states, if 34 states write a SCR calling for the state repeal amendment and include in it the wording that if the Congress does not act when 34 states have so called that there needs to be a convention, that is, in my mind, an aggregable call to convention.
You have to ask Lloyd. I don't think it is. I don't know that Lloyd is thinking that it is either.
I don't see any reason why it's not. It's right there in the wording. If 34 states appeal for this amendment and Congress does not act, we need to convene.
I mean, I'm not an attorney, but I can see how an attorney would agree with what you're saying, okay? because it is a continuing. So, in other words,
It says if these conditions are met, we're calling a convention.
And the proper course is a convention. I believe that a second action would be required. That's my opinion, but I can see where you would not think so when you read the resolution.
Yeah.
But the reason I think it's needed is that there's a little wiggle room in it, because what it says when you read it, let me bring it. I want to quote it exactly because we're into pretty deep waters now, I guess. What the language says, should Congress fail to act after two-thirds of the states petition alike in substance. Now, that's your key. What does alike in substance mean? You know, because some of the states may do something similar to us but not exact. All right? And that's the issue. So suppose theirs is slightly different. Suppose they make improvements along the way. Then, you know, that would be – we would consider that alike in substance, but they might not. That's why I think a second action is needed to resolve that. The fairest approach, every single state has to pass the exact same thing, exact. The slightest deviation, and he will say you can't aggregate them, all right? And this stuff is all – I didn't write it that stringent. When I was writing this, my intent was I just want to find out if two-thirds of the other states, honestly, agree with this amendment idea. And no strings attached. Let's just go out there and see if we can get this done, because I think it's a really big amendment. And then also express our intent that if two-thirds of our sister states agree and Congress just says, no way, we're never going to do this, then as far as we're concerned in Missouri, that's grounds, pardon my French, shove it up their hindquarters, right? Okay?
I don't know much French, but I don't think any of that was French.
I don't think that's French. Lloyd and I both agree,
French.
But I'm just ready to do the shoving now. I'm done. And Lloyd wants
to
talk
that.
More,
and, you're ready
and
to
we're
jump.
Done.
Yeah. And what I'm saying is, do you see all the opposition you're getting? You see all that opposition? That's among your friends. Why don't you try an approach? The strength of the state repeal amendment is not, it's something that you support, and it does back off, frankly. Yeah, it backs off some. But it helps you gain that two-thirds consensus, all right? It avoids, it's specific, it has advantages for all of us, and it will make that second step that you're ready to pull the trigger now. And you don't even know what amendments you want, and you're willing to pull that trigger.
No, that's not true at all. You keep saying that. You need to know that's not the truth at all. You keep saying that.
Well, then name the amendments you want.
Well, if you come to a program when I'm talking and I talk about several...
Well, how
those
about
are the ones
right
that
now?
I talk
Give
about.
Me a short
I talk
list
about
of
on
three.
The radio. I talk about everywhere I go. And but the thing is I don't
well,
talk
I
about
heard
the
of
exact
my
language.
Well, what? Don't you think that's also part of it, though? I mean, seriously. I mean, if we get serious about this, isn't that part of it? No.
I just got done saying when I talk to folks, I talk about several amendments. We talk about plenty of amendments.
Yeah, well,
once in a while we talk about the general welfare clause and the commerce clause and how that's been completely misinterpreted and how that is a huge part of what needs to be fixed. And there's probably language already written to fix that, but I don't have it, and personally that's not my role.
But then how do we know? I mean, you realize what dangerous ground we're on with this. Because in my opinion, the commerce clause and the general welfare clause are not problems in the Constitution. There are strictly problems in the interpretation.
Exactly.
Correct.
Exactly.
Do you see the difference between the state repeal amendment and what you're proposing there? Because in the case of the state repeal amendment, there's a missing check. The Constitution itself needs to be amended. This needs to be amended because this check is not there. Okay?
Oh, I agree.
That's
oh,
different.
I agree 100%.
That's
in fact,
very
it's one of
different.
I guess I had a little discussion with Dave one night when you weren't on there, or maybe somebody asked me which one, if I could only have one, and it came down to state repeal and repealing the 17th. That made me, as I recall, Dave is very strong on repealing the 17th, and I can't remember, but I'm pretty strong on the State Repeal Act being, you know, where Dave came down, and I think his I learned to agree with him. I learn every time I talk to both of you guys, is that by repealing the 17th Amendment, you're not waiting till the barn's already on fire before you have to, or, you know, you have say all the way through the process representation from the states all the way through the process. You don't just have the states trying to repeal it at the end of after it's already been done. And I think he's right on that. That's why repealing the 17th Amendment it would be hard to do. It's worthy, you know, it probably will not happen in an early convention.
I don't necessarily disagree with that assessment, but I just don't, you know, my way of approaching it is, well, let's try the petition approach and see which one gets there first, okay? That's kind of, I don't have a problem with using the petition approach. That's its strength. The strength of this approach is that there's, nobody's ever going to come up to you and say, you're going to destroy America, blah, blah, blah. No, you're not. I'm just calling for a petition. I'm just trying to find out what amendments two-thirds of the states of this country think we need. That's all I'm trying to do.
Well, yeah, and here, if I can interject for just a second, is kind of in a nutshell where we go if we get three-fourths of the states to apply for a convention, or two-thirds of the states to apply for a convention without specified amendments, is we're all sitting here agreeing that history indicates that as we near that two-thirds point, the Congress is likely to act. If we force Congress to act while we're shooting in the dark, what the hell are they going to shoot at? You know, if Congress feels forced to act on amending the Constitution simply because we've called for a convention and we haven't let them know specifically what we want, what are we asking them to do at that point?
Well, I've never looked at this process as myself personally, even though I know it's been used successfully on a number of occasions as a tool to force Congress to do things. I just don't look at it that way because, first of all, I don't believe Congress will ever act to restrain their own power in their own jurisdiction. They're just not going to do that. And so when they try to respond, you know, frankly, they're not going to know what amendment, what to do when to respond, because they're not going to want to restrain their power and jurisdiction. When we have a convention, when it's called, underneath that call to specific restrain the power and jurisdiction, the scope of the federal government, and put on fiscal restraints and term limits, those two specific things are talked about in the call in every state in which this particular convention of states is working right now. It's passed in Georgia in both houses. Those words are in there. So my point is, you know, whenever we have this convention, there are some things that will fit underneath that umbrella: term limits, fiscal restraints, number of anything that fits under restraining the scope and jurisdiction of the federal government will be germane. Other things may not be germane. They're not ratifiable. They're not something that is going to be germane in that convention.
Whoa.
Who decides what's germane and what's not? Who makes that decision?
That's a great question. First of all, what's done in that convention is controlled by several things. First of all, the call from each state, if they are identical in the operative words that would fit underneath that category, then states may also, they can restrain, they can give instructions, they give commissions to their delegates.
Let's say this convention proposes an amendment, and it restricts the federal government because it says you got to balance your budget. And then it, at the same time, in the same amendment proposal, it also says, but you can print all the money you want, and we hereby authorize the Federal Reserve, and we give everybody a right to an abortion, and add 50 other things. Now, you're going to say that's not germane. Somebody else is going to say, well, it is germane because we did limit the federal government, so we did pursue that. And who decides that question?
The
Supreme
when
Court?
The wording on that particular one, you know, let's say that came to the floor
of the convention, and it passes through. This is something the convention has
first of all, it has
to
get 26 states to pass through. 26 states like...
And I'm saying it's done. They did it. And it's not germane. Who decides it's not germane? The convention said it was. Right? They wouldn't have passed it. So they think it's germane, but you're saying, well, no, it's not. Or in other words, that convention can do whatever it wants. Whatever they decide is germane is, in fact, germane.
I don't agree, but...
Well, then who decides? If Congress decides, you just defeated the whole purpose. So Congress cannot decide. If the Supreme Court decides, in my opinion, that also defeats the whole purpose. That's the federal government doing it again. You got to understand the power that this convention has. You keep trying to limit. If you thought this convention was unlimited, would you still have it, yes or no?
No.
Okay, you're afraid of an unlimited convention. You think you
there
can
are two
restrict
kinds.
It?
There's a number of conventions. There's polypenitentiary conventions, which are unlimited. And by the way, which can be called under Article 5. But so can limited conventions.
No, limited Article conventions 5 says nothing about limited or unlimited. It just says convention to propose amendment. That's it says nothing about limited or unlimited.
But if the states send their commissioners to that particular convention and they limit them to talk about and vote on specific issues underneath that call, those commissioners are not only limited, they can be recalled. And in some states, they can go to jail if they go outside their commission.
Yeah, well, okay, so Missouri limits theirs, and then the other 49 say, well, we didn't limit ours the same way. So
but that's not what's happened. I don't see it.
It's never been done before. Okay.
Well,
I mean, that is what happened in 1787.
Well,
I'm
just saying
right?
that so far
understand.
The states, nearly all the states that have passed it so far, have companion bills that limit their delegates.
How long
is this? 1787 as your example, which that's the closest thing we've got, although I don't think it's all that close. But it's the one everybody knows. Those guys had a convention. They threw out the Articles of Confederation. They changed
well, we
the way
get back. We can go to the conventions. We can go to the 22 conventions before that. We can go to the 11 conventions after. And even one in this particular regional convention in this century that followed.
There's
the,
never been an amendment convention. I don't know what you're referring to.
No, I didn't say an amendment convention. I just said they are state conventions, though. I mean, there are conventions, in this case, regional conventions. They're not Article 5 conventions, no.
Well, there's Lions Club conventions, too.
They actually follow the same rules, and they have followed the same rules that were followed before the founding and after.
Oh, you're talking about like...
I'm disputing the rules. Yeah, I'm saying we're going to follow the rules. It's going to be one state, one vote, and the states are going to pick the delegates. But there is an inherent power in my opinion. You've told me if that convention were unlimited, you would oppose it. Okay, so now it becomes a substantive
issue. I believe
it's,
yeah, right.
Okay, so
that's
you don't want it
that's
unlimited.
That's why that I'm working
it
for.
It has to be limited.
We work together. Every state that's called thus far and every state that I'm working with will call with that specific language, and the specific language is calling for an Article 5 convention, by the way, which is just simply for proposing amendments to restrain the power and jurisdiction of the federal government.
Let me intercede here for a minute. I want to ask your question right back to you, Keith. Here, you think this is going to take 2 or 3 years?
At least.
What's going to happen when the convention meets and the delegates from Georgia have a charge that if they violate? They could potentially be recalled and potentially go to jail, except for the fact that all of the people who voted on that charge, they're termed out, and there's a whole new legislature.
Doesn't make the law invalid.
Exactly right, but it does make the likelihood that the legislature of the state of Georgia is going to recall those delegates if they go off and try to propose quote-unquote, non-germane amendments. What I'm saying
there may be states that might fit in that category, but Georgia wouldn't be a good example, no.
Well,
they have almost two-thirds majority, and that's before 2014.
I said Georgia because they're the first, they're going to be farthest removed in time from having, from having done this to the time that the convention, I picked Georgia because they're going to be the oldest kids on the block when it comes to actually convening. But But what I'm saying is there is no guarantee. There is not even any likelihood.
Yeah, the law wouldn't be valid, but the political will to do that, you're right. The political will to do that may change based on factors within each state's legislature. No question about that. I mean, that's the real world.
Okay.
So, but my question is, so let's just think about what we're deciding. We're deciding either to, okay, we have two choices or three, but basically the decision is we go forward or we don't go forward because we're worried about that.
Oh,
I'm going to go forward. Is that a consideration? Yes, that can be a consideration.
It's always going to be a consideration. I'm going to go forward unafraid and untrembling, opposed to any attempts to try to control the convention, and believing, in fact knowing, that you can't control the convention.
You cannot. I agree.
And I'm going to go forward anyway. There was no talk.
I agree, because I'll take state legislators as a whole. Now, I wouldn't just take this is just going to be a convention, but the only folks who are coming are from New England states, or just going to come from these 18 states or these 13 states or even half of them. It's going to have to be the whole. And it makes sense, obviously. You wouldn't have a convention without it. But if a state doesn't want to come, they don't have to come. But the point is, I'll take the aggregate of the state legislators or the people, any way you want to put them, but it's got to be in the aggregate, one state, one vote, any day over a runaway Congress. We're under the danger of a runaway Congress every day Congress is convened, and we all three agree with that.
Correct. There's no disagreement on that. The disagreements are where we really need to focus so we can try and get agreement and not break ourselves apart.
Right.
And that's what I'm trying to do with the petition approach, which you don't oppose. I don't oppose it.
I think it's a good idea, and if it goes forward, and we're all going to hopefully end up at the same place.
I mean,
it's a matter of
in my
opinion, but I want to use my analogy, because I don't think you understand at least where I see myself, and I'm just talking personally. When I look across the table, if we're all sitting at a table,
the convention of states, and
there's
I think they're better funded.
I didn't hear that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's rude. I apologize for that. But I'm an idiot. It's not hard for me to guess what motives are here. Yours are good motives. I think there's a lot of faith in Michael Ferris. He's been a good man.
Let me take my role.
You know, and I think there's a lot of money behind the Convention of States. There's none behind what I'm trying here. But, you know, there's not openness, as far as I can tell, other than yourself, within the Convention of States a different approach. They're committed to this one. And...
Let me use my analogy, see if it helps. If we were all sitting at the table, I look over across the table, and we're three very different people, and yet we all agree on a lot of things. But when I look over at Lloyd Sloan, I see someone who's very intelligent, knows history, knows history better than anybody that I know personally, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know what Dave thinks about that, but I'd say, you know, he's definitely in the top three of anybody that I know. When I look at people like you mentioned Michael Ferris and other folks, I look at people who are very intelligent. Now, my role is I'm not going to go in the operating room when it comes time to be a delegate in a convention of states. The very first Article 5 Convention of States, which, by the way, let me just say, if there's anything we need, we need people selected from each state to sit down in a room and lock out the media and have this meeting. Everybody's scared of this meeting. It's nothing but a study committee with the power to make recommendations. That's all it is. And so my role is to set the chairs, to turn on the lights, and make sure the meeting happens. I'm not going in the emergency room. I don't know how to use a scalpel. I don't know how to make sutures. You know, if I have to operate on you, Lloyd, and you're bleeding and you're in a bad way, you know, the best thing I can do for you is pray for you, brother, because I'm not going to be much good as a doctor or physician, and I'm not going to be much good in a constitutional meeting You would be. I'm just saying my role.
I don't know anybody that's comfortable doing that, to be honest. If they are, you probably don't want them in the room because they're way too arrogant for this.
Are you beginning to see what I'm saying? I'm not talking about amendments a lot because I'm leaving that to people who do know.
But I'm also saying don't buy a pig in a poke. I mean, I am, you know, it's wrong. And, you know, you can't just say, well, I trust that doctor. You can say that, okay? You've got to understand, that's the argument. I trust that doctor, period. I know it doesn't make sense to me yet what he's saying, but I trust what he's saying. I'm just going to follow what he's doing. And I'm arguing a different approach. We need to
Let me use one example. I don't know. This may be a poor thing. There's a person that's a very good close friend of you, and nearly every time I see you, I see him. Okay, if he was selected to the committee to go in this, I trust him as a person. After I don't know him a great deal, but I know him enough to say he's a lot more qualified than I would ever be. I would vote for him in a minute to go and be a delegate in this convention. Now, there's going to be several, had several suggestions, and most of the time the people that are suggested based on the fact that they know the Constitution, they've been either during their tenure somewhere, they've demonstrated a knowledge and a love for the Constitution, original intent of the Constitution, but they're also considered fair, bipartisan, and they can do things in a bipartisan atmosphere. And we need to remember that whatever we try to do in this convention when it happens, hey, nothing's going to happen and nothing's going to be ratified unless it's common sense, whether it's reasonable, fair, and bipartisan. It's just going to have to be that way.
Yeah, you are truly committed to the convention as an end in itself, and I'm not. And I'd like to avoid it.
Why is that? Why do you say that? Because, you know, it's like this.
Because of what you just told me in your analogy.
No. I'm committed in getting this
approved. You're committed to the convention. You want it to happen. There is no amendment whatsoever.
I want this patient in the operating room, and I want the very best people that can be selected from each state to be in that room.
The operating room is the convention. You already know you want the operation. I'd like to avoid the operation if possible.
I think Dave would agree that we've got a situation in which we need some serious. There's some serious work, and there's a lot of people who want to fiddle while Washington burns. I'm not one of those people.
Well, this may be where the because what we're really doing is, the patient is clearly sick and it needs an amendment. I am very specific in the amendment it needs. You think it needs an amendment, you don't know which one.
I think it needs five amendments.
Well, then, what's wrong with doing a petition approach on those five just to see if we got 2/3 of states behind them?
I think we've got 2/3 of the states who will listen to those five now. They may not all be ratified, but they'll listen.
Why don't we take that approach? Let's find out, you know. That's a perfectly safe thing to do, and it would tell us what's out there.
Let me ask this question. Why is a meeting in which people are selected from each state, respected people are selected and put in a room and close the door and shut out the media? They can't be controlled because there's groups from every state. Some have 11 people. Some of them have 5 people. They all have one vote when they caucus. What's the danger of having those folks get together? Hell, get together next week.
Why not do
room.
It then? Just do it and don't make it binding. Just let's see what they come up with. I don't have a problem with it. Well, what's wrong with that?
We don't have an understanding of what they are. I just said while ago they're a study committee with the power to recommend, and that's all they are.
I get to talk for a minute now.
Go for it, Dave.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a concern more than a year ago when I saw this national organization developing that the grassroots people, the real rulers of this country, the plumbers and the pipe fitters, the concrete layers, were losing control. And the mantra from the conservative naysayers was always, we don't want a convention because the left is too strong. We don't want a convention because the liberal media is too strong. And they'll run in and they'll seize control of this thing and we'll totally lose everything. And what I see now is just the opposite. What I see now is the right saying, well, because some people were afraid that we would lose control, we're going to make sure that we take total control. I see that as less than democratic. I see that as less than what the founders intended. I see that, quite frankly, as disrespectful to the founding principles, as contending that we shouldn't have one at all because we're afraid. Now, that's just me. But
well, you heard me say we're going to have to be bipartisan. That's not taking full control. That's realizing that there's 18 state legislators controlled at this point by another party, who can also do math.
But here's the thing. Here's something that you said, Keith. That yes, Lloyd knows a whole hell of a lot more about history than I do. But I do not want to turn this thing over to the brain trust, quite frankly. History tells us one thing. The majority of productive work, and when I say productive work, I'm talking about the guy who said, I don't want them taking my guns. I'm talking about the guy who said, I don't want them telling me what church I got to go to. I'm talking about the guy who said, okay, let's find some compromise here that saves this convention, that saves the union. Those weren't the brains in the room. Those were the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the hunters. Those were the soldiers. Those were the blacksmiths that were in the room. So when
they
it comes
to, serve. Came to serve as what? They came to serve as some type of a delegate at the convention.
They did, but I cringe when I hear people who live day-to-day lives like you, Keith, and I have all the respect in the world for you and what you could bring to this table, say, well, I don't want to get my hands in the guts because I'm just not smart enough. I think we need this thing to emanate from the grassroots level. I think we need this thing to continue to roll from the people, from the very people whose day-to-day lives depend on this. Okay, you guys go back at it.
Well, that's a good point.
I'd rather keep it productive, but I think as a practical matter, what I see happening here, I will say this, we're in a horse race. The Convention of States is, or whatever, and the Levin approach is way ahead of SRA, which never gets mentioned, obviously. It has no basis. You only know about it in Missouri. The petition approach has only been tried here, too, so it clearly is ahead in the horse race. But I do believe that it's going to be easier to do the petition approach, that if it does catch on, it will blow way past Convention of States because it meets the objection. So if people do look at it and say, yeah, we like SRA, so we'll very quickly pass the petition. We'll get to two-thirds rapidly. And we may get to two-thirds rapidly on several other amendments. And in which case, you know, if Congress doesn't act, we'll get the convention you want. Meanwhile, you'll still be struggling to pass it in states that, frankly, have already passed a balanced budget amendment approach. And you're just asking to pass, okay, here's the other magic words that we can pass that'll make this limited and do all this other stuff. And we are spinning our wheels, in my opinion, going way too slow.
Lloyd has a great point, but that's why I've been mentioning the state repeal amendment every time I speak, and that's another reason I think I woke up about a week ago at 5 a.m., bright and just absolutely fully awake, thinking there's something else that we're missing, and what we need to do is we need to concentrate, and really state repeal amendment is the only thing I can think of is that meets the question is what it is that will get the folks on the other side of the aisle, and I used to use that term loosely, I mean everyone, what is it that will get these folks who normally won't vote with you and I they'll never vote with us on anything, but they'll vote with us on this. That a state repeal amendment is the only thing I can think of that can bring this together. And Lloyd's exactly right. We might be able to get 30. We might be able to get 31. But you got to have all of them. You got to have the full two-thirds. You got
to
have
34. I'd like to get 38.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I mean, that would
believe
awesome.
Believe me, with 31 SCRs worded the way ours is, Congress starts wetting themselves.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you're giving them too much credit for being principled. These are not, I believe, principled people. They will do whatever. They're brilliant at politics, far better than we are. They do it for a living. They're quite skilled, and they will try and distract us, and they'll do a lot of things to do that, and that's always a concern. But would they stop? Would they, you know, what they'll try and do is pass something that really isn't what we want but looks like it is. That's
right.
What they'll try and do.
That's right.
That's probably your biggest. And then you got to make a decision.
And
that's
what's going to happen. And that's the same thing that's going to happen when the 30th and 31st states sign on for a convention of states. I mean, you're going to start seeing bones thrown out to try to back this thing off in a hurry.
Yeah.
Let me tell you how I figure. My dad passed away last spring, and he was about 26 years old when I was born. So I know if there's not a disease, and of course he was a smoker, but my point is when I look at this thing, there's a finite number of days and hours that I have here on this earth, and there's a lot of things I can spend my time doing and enjoy. But when I look at my two granddaughters who will turn 30 and 2040, I just don't feel like fishing. I feel like trying to find a solution that won't put them, their lives and their children's lives, they'll give them a little hope of not going through a period of discouragement, despair and decay and debt. And that's what drives me. And so when I look at the various approaches, and we all have to do that. Which one is going to get us there first? I don't know. Lloyd may be absolutely right by taking what I would call, you could call this a soft touch approach. It is. It's like let's feel this out a little bit as we go. And sometimes, you know, you can get where you're wanting to be by taking a different route, and it ends up getting there, you know. But as I look at Article 5, it gives states the opportunity to propose amendments, and that's what I want them to have the opportunity to do that. And they can only do that. They can do that any time in a session when they get together that's not binding. They can get together and brainstorm, but they can only get ratifiable amendments proposed in an official Article 5 convention. Now,
that is correct.
This has to happen. As far as I'm concerned, I'm going to spend my time trying to make it happen. Now, do I trust all politicians? Do I trust very many politicians? I had to make this statement the other day. The more that I learn to get to personally know state legislators, now, I've known a few, but I spent just a limited amount of time in the Capitol and going to Lincoln Days, and I've spent some time talking to some folks on the other side of the aisle, trying to understand what they're thinking and what would make them, you know, what would bring them to the table. And the more I meet these people, no, they're not all perfect, and they're just sometimes they're pretty sleazy. But the ones I've been meeting in Missouri give me a lot of hope. I see the genius of the founders putting this process in their hands 220-some years ago.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. That's without having the states as an option, we would not have the Bill of Rights. I think the historians will agree with that. Without the states having that option, probably we wouldn't even have the Constitution, honestly, because they would never have passed it if
never
they didn't have their own. Yeah, that's probably true. They would never have ratified. They needed that out to even get to ratification. And so, and frankly, the proposal to have a state convention was passed unanimously at the 1787 convention, too. It's not, there wasn't much discussion on it. It wasn't like anybody opposed that as an option. I think they recognized the need for it and saw it as a necessary check in the system.
Well, I think to some degree, none of us were there, but after looking at the wording in, as they began and the wording in August and then what came out of the committees in September, frankly, I can see why some folks were upset, and there was probably some that were embarrassed because went from August, when which Congress had the exclusive, I mean, Congress wasn't even mentioned. The states had the exclusive ability to initiate the amending process in August when it came out of the Committee of Detail. And when it came out of the Committee of Style, you know, it's almost like, this doesn't even look like what we had in August because Congress has exclusive ability to start this. And obviously I can see why it was passed unanimously because it goes back to what they really began to do in the, you know, back in June.
4 minutes and 30 seconds. Keith, wrap up in 60.
Well, I just want to let folks know, Lloyd and I go at it kind of hard sometimes, but we learn a lot from, I don't learn much from Lloyd, but I really respect him, and I support this state repeal amendment. I actually, every time I get the group together, I talk about it, and there are other things that I think will come out of a convention of states, but I hope folks will just take a minute, go to conventionofstates.com, that they'll, you know, if you want to keep up with the process, you actually have to go to the Action Center and join. I hope you'll do that. Lloyd, I hope you have a great evening. It's been great to talk to you.
As always, Keith, thanks for dropping in. You drop in anytime. I'm here Friday and Saturday night. I'm always anxious to talk to you, see how things are going over there at Convention of States. I'm behind Convention of States. I'm behind the petition. I'm behind state repeal amendment. I'm behind everything that's going on to put the federal government back in its box. Thanks, Keith. Drop by anytime. Lloyd, wrap up in 60.
Can't do much better than you just did, but if they want to help out this process on the petition approach and like that, and they're interested in a state repeal amendment, then the bill to support is the SCR 38 in Missouri right now. Sponsor is Senator Lamping, and all help's appreciated. Let's get a hearing for this.
Absolutely. Listen, folks, you folks that are in and on board with this Convention of the States, this is not a betrayal for you to get in on this thing too. By any means, there is no reason why, just like me, you can't support both the Convention of the States and get your emails and phone calls in to the Senate Rules Committee and Senator Lamping right now, and also get on board with this thing here. Okay, that's gonna have to be a wrap for tonight. Thank you very much, Lloyd. Just like Keith, you know I love talking to you, and I want to tell you that you don't need an invite. You call in here any Friday or Saturday night, and we'll throw around either this or whatever the hell we happen to be talking about that night. Your opinion is valued on any and everything that we talk about here, except fair taxation, and. But you know, I know what they teach you. I know what they teach you, Harvard guys. All right, Lloyd, love you. Take care. We'll talk to you next time. Bye bye. All right, that's it for tonight, folks. What an interesting night. Listen, it's not either or on this Convention of the States and this petition process. It's not either or. You can have both. Both working simultaneously. What you need to do this week, please, no matter how 100% behind Convention of States you are or opposed to it. Listen, if you're opposed to the Convention of the States, this is the perfect route for you. Go to senate.mo.gov, read SCR 38, and then email and telephone Lamping and the members of the House or of the Senate Rules Committee, and let's get this thing rolling. We need to see some progress on this term. I don't want to sound pessimistic, but I don't want to be overly optimistic that we're going to get this thing done this term. I'd love to, and there's no reason we shouldn't push as though we expect to, but let's get something going. This is exciting. These are exciting times. This is the first time anyone in the country in a governing body has talked seriously even about SRA. So I really want to see us move this thing. We'll talk about this more next week, I promise. I'm Dave. This is Grassroots Radio. You've been listening to the Hour of Truth.
There are so many contradictions in all these messages we send. Keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit in? Though the world is torn and shaking, even if your heart is breaking, it's waiting for you to awaken. Someday you will learn to be.